I'm not exactly sure how to begin, but that's a beginning in itself. Anyway, I'm very pleased to have been invited. I'll have to tell you a little bit about my current situation, I think, as a way of starting, before we go into ordination and my spiritual journey beyond ordination. So this morning at 6 o'clock, I rose in the darkness of my static caravan and stepped outside to see the first rays of light coming over the hills. And all was quiet and quite warm. And I went and fed 14 guinea pigs, 5 doves, 3 budgerigars, 3 finches, 2 cats, and then me. And by then it was daylight, and a blackbird rose up in the fir tree and carolled such melodies as I walked down to the bus stop to get the bus, to get the other bus, to get the train, to get the next train, to get out of the train, to get on the tube and come here. That's a day's journey. I live in mid Wales in a static caravan, sometimes called a mobile home, which isn't true because they don't go anywhere, so they're static caravans. At the moment, without gas, water or electricity. So it's been a little bit tough the last wee while. So, yeah, I thought, well, I'll just think about the talk then, because I can't do other things. Yeah, all day long I can just look at the hills, and I do spend an awful lot of time just looking at the hills and never tire of that, and I can go several days without speaking to anybody. Hence, it is quite sort of going up a bit to be addressing you all this evening for, I gather, up to an hour. So that's where I am now, in Mid Wales. But some 30 odd years ago, I suppose, I lived not very far from here in a locality called London Fields. Some of you may know London Fields, Lansdowne Drive. Started out in a squat, or was squatting there, and eventually was a housing co-op, and came across the Dharma during that period. So how did I get from there to here, or here to there? I'll try and unfold a little. But I'll go to my ordination, because the sort of build up to that is, you know, quite an extensive period in itself. But when I was trying to collate some thoughts around this whole talk, I realised it could quite well become a lot of random reminiscing, because as one starts to look into the past, you might think, well, it's easy to talk about yourself, but looking into the past, and then more and more memories start coming up, and then the memories get other memories joined onto them, and, you know, before we know where we are, we're off somewhere, you know, with the fairies somewhere else. So how do I make this coherent? So I've got a list of headings here, you know, and if I start going astray, I can at least refer to that. I'll try and make it coherent. So as Shubha told you, I was ordained in 1984 at a place called Battle. I didn't think much of that at the time, and didn't much into that. I know you've already had some talks by the elders, so probably a certain amount of reminiscing about, you know, how things were in the old days and the way we did things then, and petrol was 2 and 6 a gallon, and, you know, all the rest of it, and, you know, things ain't what they used to be. And you're going to get some more of that. It's me. Okay, so in those days, before Taraloka, before, what is it, Vajrasana that you have, before Akashavana, before Tiratnaloka, before Water Hall, if some of you remember Water Hall. Before any of them, we had held our retreats in schools, in school holidays, obviously. Let's be too chaotic. In boarding schools. We'd go along with a van full of meditation cushions, Buddhas, not this one, a bit big, all kinds of the usual paraphernalia, and arrive at a school and create a retreat for 5 days, 10 days, a couple of weeks. And we did already have women's retreats at that time in 1984. In fact, it was a women's retreat that got me to sort of stay with this movement at all, because it was the first summer I was involved. There was a 3 week long women's retreat at a place called Nandara that I went to. The things that hadn't been for that, I wouldn't have felt there was a connection for me. So here we are in battle, and first thing to do is, like, you know, take down, well, in some of the places you have to take the stag's head off the wall, you know, and the antlers, and the pictures of people shooting things. You've got quite a lot of that in some of those older buildings, which were often country houses converted into boarding schools, you know. And then you had to sort of cover up the notice board with all the thing about the hockey teams and everything else like that. And then you had to make the library into a sort of secret shrine for the ordinations. So, about a week before this retreat happened, Anjali came round to see me. She said, "What are you doing next week?" I said, "Oh, I was thinking I might go on that retreat, but I'm not sure really." She said, "Well, perhaps you should go because Sangharakshita wants to ordain you." All right. In that case. So I went. The retreat was a week long. It was an open women's retreat, so any woman could go, whether she'd had any contact or no. It was summertime. It was August. And I had discovered I was to be ordained with two other women, whom I'd scarcely met, one from West London and one from Croydon. And we shared a room, but we didn't say much because we soon went into silence, and Sangharakshita came, and we had our private ordination in the library, which then was sort of swathed in lovely coloured cloths so you couldn't sort of get distracted by the books. And they put little fairy lights up the stairs, and in an ordination, private ordination evening, everybody's meditating, and you go out one by one to the secret place where you meet the person who's going to ordain you. So Jenny went first, and I went second, and Else went third. We didn't come back, Jenny, Noel, and Else, but we didn't know who we were, because that was secret. When Sangharakshita announced my name, I thought he said something other than Varabhadri. But I saw my name come from his mouth in golden letters. Did come streaming out golden letters, Varabhadri. But my brain thought he'd said Vidyadhara. Why? I don't know. I don't think I even heard the name Vidyadhara. That's what I heard. Isn't that strange? So he said, "Well, your name's Varabhadri. And that means Vara, supreme, eminent. Bhadri, auspicious, spiritual companion." So that's the meaning of my name, Varabhadri. And in due course, we had the public ceremony when it was revealed that my two sisters, my two co-ordainees, were Sarvabhadri and Gunabhadri. Sarvabhadri, she who is the auspicious friend of all, and Gunabhadri, she possessing all spiritual qualities. Sarvabhadri sadly resigned some years ago, but Gunabhadri is back in her native Holland. And, funnily enough, although we didn't know each other hardly at all, in the course of time, we all ended up being mitra conveners. So we got to know each other quite well in that space of time. That was good fun. Well, in the ordination ceremony, I was highly, highly nervous. So nervous, in fact, that I couldn't really concentrate. My stomach was going like a washing machine. It really was. And it was summertime, as I said, and we were in this, you know, big sort of, I suppose it was a school hall, with big bay windows at the end, and they were slightly open. So I spent some time figuring out how I could surreptitiously leave the room, get out through the bay window, be sick in the flower bed, get back in, and no one would notice. No one would notice a thing. I really thought that. But after I'd figured that out, I felt much better and could concentrate on what Sangha Akshato was doing. Yes, I didn't know I was going to be like that. Well, I came back to the London Buddhist Centre, and not long after, I began to take classes. I was working in the cherry orchard as well. And in fact, it was in this very room that I led my first meditation class over here, the lunchtime meditation classes that were free at that time. That was my very first teaching experience, not long after ordination in 1984. So I was working in the cherry orchard. Many of you remember the cherry orchard? That's cherry orchard, yeah. Well, I had a hand in that, starting that up. I'd like it to be known. Before the cherry orchard was there, we didn't have anywhere to eat, and there was a lot of building work going on around here in the late 70s. So I started up a soup kitchen, and what was in the offices above the cherry orchard, and people came to eat my soup. And then I think it was Marlene had the idea, let's have a proper restaurant. So we started, you know, furnishing the place as a cafe, as a restaurant, and opened it up. And then we started to get not only people but mice coming in. I know, being Buddhists, what do you do? What do you do when your kitchen is full of mice and slugs? Well, they had the bright idea of sending me, why me, down to Brick Lane. And in those far-off days, you could, in Brick Lane, purchase cats, kittens, dogs, and probably all kinds of other things. So I was commissioned to purchase a cat to deal with the mice, and cat not having Buddhist aspirations, so that'd be all right. I came back with two little kittens, and for half a crown, which is 12.5p these days, and put them in there, and I think they sorted things out a bit. I don't know what happened in the end. I stayed in the cherry, working in the cherry orchard for many years, both before and after ordination, and also whilst I was doing that, starting to do classes, working in the cherry orchard, I began with a woman called Ratna Dharkani, and I think Dharma Dinner for a while. Downstairs, we had a stained glass studio. We started to do stained glass work. Ratna Dharkani was, you know, well expert, and she'd made a beautiful window for the cherry orchard, and so we were her disciples down there cutting glass, with the thought that we'd go out to the markets and be selling all these beautiful things and getting commissions to do lots of repairs on the old doors, but didn't quite get to be like that. But it was a great to learn the craft from someone. And then another thing I did here was lead Parinirvana Days. I think Parinirvana Day is probably coming up, or have you had it? Coming up, yes. That became my favourite festival, if festival's the right word. I just very much had the heart for it. And I think I must have led five or six of those days here. They are, of course, you know, pretty much at the crux of things, isn't it, if we're thinking of impermanence and what we're doing here and all the rest of it. So I noticed this year there's a theme on spiritual death and rebirth. Well, you know, at all levels, we're dealing with death and rebirth all the time. But I particularly enjoyed doing those festivals. In fact, one of them, I remember Sangharakshita's mother had just died at the age of 92. And so, you know, I it was my task to include her in the remembrances and in the metta. Then we purchased Waterhall, I started leading retreats at Waterhall. And I think that was where, well, I know it was where we had our first lesbian weekend, or was it a week? I'm not sure. I think it was a weekend, actually. You know, we're still talking back in the late 80s. There's a lot of things that have moved on since then, but this was back in the 80s. So it felt a little bit experimental in a way. And I think experiment is something that I would say is a feature of me. We're moving along to that soon. So I took up the Mitra convening somewhere in the mid-80s. And my predecessor was named Vidyashree, and she'd done it for a great number of years. And I just felt that was a natural progression to come into Mitra convening. Didn't have a clue what it involved, really, because I was still quite young. I was maybe 3 or 4 years old as an order member. But during my time as Mitra convener, I think the peak, the top number was 66 Mitras. No idea, of course, how many you have now. I did my best. I did my best to stay in touch with people. It was my duty to provide Mitra study for them, and it was a different Mitra study course to think what you've got now. So I won't say coerce the order members, that would give a entirely wrong impression. Invite the order members of the region to come and lead the Mitra study. This is a responsibility you take on. When someone becomes a Mitra, it is the responsibility of the order to make study available. You know, it's a sort of, there's a two-way relationship starts to evolve. When we made people Mitras back in those days, it was quite a long, drawn-out procedure, and it involved lots of meetings. In fact, when I think back now to my years here, meetings, there always seemed to be in a meeting, one sort or another, if it wasn't a council meeting, a Cherry Orchard meeting, a chapter meeting, or a Mitra Convenience meeting, or a meeting about meetings, probably. So what used to happen is that we'd go to the Mitra Convenience meeting with a list of women from our centre whom we felt, you know, were ready to become Mitras, and we actually put it to the whole meeting, to the whole country, virtually. And in that way, we sought to establish a kind of unity, you know, so that wherever you went as a Mitra, you know, it was, you know, you were accepted as a Mitra, and people knew roughly, you know, what sort of things you'd been studying, you'd been doing. I don't think that happens anymore, but that was all part of my life then. You know, passing the Mitra requests. So, meetings can go on and on, can't they? But they, our Mitra convenience meetings livened up a little, I think, when Vajramala and Kalyana Shri took part and we started going horse riding. not everybody had done any horse riding, and some of us hadn't done it for some years. We had to have it in the latter half of the meeting, otherwise we wouldn't have been able to get out of bed, I think, some of us. But, you know, oh dear, in the back and everything. But it brought some fun into it. So we began to extend the meeting. So they were more like little retreats and really getting to know one another, you know, as you know, without the sort of hats on, as it were. It was so important because there's so many roles that we can find ourselves, you know, taking on when, you know, engaging with a busy centre. And you know, sort of slowing down a little bit to give time to see, you know, who we are underneath, talking around whatever, you know, our business is to talk about. Busy order members in the 1980s all had a Filofax. And the fatter the Filofax, of course, the busier they were. I think nowadays there's all kinds of strange things that people communicate with called Twitters and chatters and what is it? tweeting. And, you know, never mind emails, but, you know, the sort of high-tech stuff which is beyond me. But even the Filofax was beyond me. I steadfastly refused to have one, even a diary, because I probably would have forgotten to look into it anyway. But it was a strange sort of time. I think I did fairly well in not forgetting too many appointments that I'd made. And if anyone wants to say, gainsay me, I do apologise. I honestly don't think the Filofax would have helped, and it was a heavy thing to carry around. I think they've all gone now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I remember from them. Yeah. 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 I did lots of travelling as well, somehow. I kept all the Mitra convening and working in the cherry orchard together, and also went travelling. At one time, we opened up the cherry orchard to be in the evening as well as in the daytime, and our team grew to 17 at least. 17 women working in the cherry orchard, you know, think of the meetings. Think of the crossovers. And you know, sometimes you wouldn't get home to 1:30 in the morning. Oh dear. But somehow I managed to do other things. So one of the lovely things I remember is being invited to go abroad. And I went to Germany quite a few times at a place called Kuhuda, which I gather translated means cow hut. But the cows had long gone. So, yeah. And this was often in the winter time. We had snow sort of up to here. And I met a very dear friend there called Gunavati, who sadly passed now. And I loved going abroad. Something about language that I don't understand enables me to feel something more of the spirit of a retreat, the spirit of a place. So I was very happy not understanding German, but I went and learnt it anyway, because I went enough times that I began to be able to speak German. It was very good just to be away, not just from the city, but from the familiarity. I know I'm hopping around a bit, but it just reminded me that if there is a theme in this talk, it's about going forth. It's about going forth. We hear a lot of talk about going for refuge, but I talk about going forth. Can't go for refuge if you haven't gone forth. I'm not sure whether going forth implies, therefore, that one is going for refuge, but you've definitely got to go forth on repeatedly all the time. And this has been very much a feature in my life in the order, or even before. So this going forth from the familiar is what has helped me to grow the most. So I would go off to Germany and not be able to talk that fluently with the women. Not all the women had English that much. My dear friend Joan Sitter, sitting here, was very supportive in those retreats. I loved it. I loved being in the snow, in the absolute blank, as it were, landscape. Just purity, the purity element of those retreats. And wrote a lot of poetry there. I wrote a lot of poetry in my years around here. I don't seem to do that now. But I'm going to read you one, if I may, because it does touch on going forth, and I think this is a good enough point to put it in. But it's not from Germany. It's not one of the ones in Germany. Today, there is a shimmer of new green across the faraway hills, and every tree I pass quivers in anticipation. The time of the coming forth is near. but I am forgotten about. I have died, or almost, to the world that knew me, to those who thought they knew me. Yet this must be done over and over, apparently dying. This precedes the new coming to be, the Renaissance, and no two times are ever the same. For if it looked to be so, then there is no sacrament. For it is to make all holy. This is the meaning of sacrifice. So let me be sacrificed. Fear, taking demonic guise, obstructs the entrance to all mystery, must be overcome. I shall pacify fear, I shall stand firm, I shall give her a treasure to guard with her life. And in this way, my path becomes softer, lighter. So, in the beginning I went forth from a group, and that group was my peers in the sort of lesbian, separatist, feminist world and the pub. And that's pretty much what I knew. I was a single parent and not feeling that I was being a very good parent. And when I met the Dharma, then I went forth from socialising in that manner and left most of my friends away in that world. And when I was ordained, I went forth again from the familiar, the growing security of the Sangha. And later on, there's another going forth. I've also been going forth all these years, I think, to a fixed view of myself. The fixed view that essentially, in today's parlance, I was a waste of space, because that's where I started from. So you see why going forth is so important to me. And I was talking about going forth in terms of going off to other countries, so we'll go back there now. We'll go to Australia and New Zealand, because also in the early 90s, I think it was, I was kind of commissioned or dispatched, I'm not sure what's the right phrase for it, to Australia and to New Zealand. And, oh, I hate flying. I'm terrified. I don't know how I do it, or did it. But off I flew for 6 amazing weeks in the Antipodes, where I gave a series of talks in both countries and was very generously shown around and received much friendship and hospitality, and sat on a beach where if you dug a hole the hot water came up, and you sat in this hot water, and if you put it near to the edge of the tide because you needed some cold to come in. And I kept wondering why it never got cold like a bath. Well, yeah, it wasn't all about sitting on the beach in hot water. Sometimes it was sitting in a shrine room in another kind of hot water, giving talks and going on their retreats. It was wonderful, it was wonderful. So, you know, yeah, this is what it's brought for me, these opportunities. Travel the world, meet people. I never knew the breadth of connections that were to be made. My world had been very small, and now I was finding myself meeting women from all walks of life, from all backgrounds, from all viewpoints, I would never have otherwise have done, I think. And furthermore, yeah, hopefully little by little, learning to communicate with them. And I think this is just such a wonderful, wonderful gift. Well, the summer of 94... Oh, Tara Loka, have we got time? Yes. Tara Loka came into being in 1986, and I remember the first order weekend up there in the freezing cold, and their dreadful, dreadful wallpaper. It was all like this, things in what is now Sardinandi's room, if you're ever invited in there. and the outbuildings were still very much like a derelict, semi-derelict barn. I went on to lead a number of quite mad retreats at Tararuca. Oh, they were great. I led one called Milarepa and the Story of the Yak's Horn. Any of you know Milarepa? Milarepa was a yogi, lived up in the hills on nettles. And I'm afraid I deeply disturbed Sangha Devi, who was chair at Tararuca at the time, when she came in to see how I was getting on with setting up the shrine for this retreat. And what she saw was an entirely naked shrine. I'd taken the Buddha off and everything else, and then I put a cooking pot on it, filled with nettles. And I had to reassure her that the Buddha would reappear in the course of the retreats, and of course he did, along with Milarepa, and a very large yak's horn, with Milarepa sitting inside. And we acted out that story on that retreat. It was great fun. And another time we built a stupa. The stupa is behind. And that was the year of the death of Dado Rinpoche, who was Bhante's teacher, one of Bhante's teachers, lived in Kalimpong in Nepal. But of course, you plan retreats an awful long time ahead, and I'd already planned this retreat on the stupa. And being the sort of person I am, I felt we had to build one. It wasn't good enough just to talk about it, to look at pictures of it, visualise it, or anything else. We had to go outside and build one. So we did. It was a rather odd-looking stupa. It was not quite straight. It began to lean as time went on. It was manufactured largely of cardboard, string, papier-mâché, bits of wood, and an awful lot of lime wash, I think. But day by day, stage by stage, we built our stupa and performed the meditations and the rituals associated with it. And it was on the day when we had to place what's called the harmika, which is the old fire altar, and in geometrical images appears red, representing the fire. It was on that day that the earthquake came. Yes, there was an earthquake in Tararuca. Pictures did fall off the walls, and the floor did shake a bit, and the stupa leaned over a bit. Push it back up. Now, I don't know if you've been at Tararuca when there's been an earthquake. Apparently in Britain we do experience quite a number every year, but there's just very little. But the thing that shook me, and I think shook the rest of the retreat even more than the earthquake, was then discovering later on that it was that same day that Dado Rinpoche had been cremated, and they'd taken his ashes, which had fallen down from the harmika in his funerary stupa, and you know, took them out and looked at them on that very same day. So, yeah, these were sort of things that went on when I was leading retreats. and then there was the five Buddha mandala, building the Buddha land. That was an epic. We had a big marquee up in the big field. There was only about 55, 60 of us or so. And we divided up into five groups, or kulas if you like, one for each of the five Buddhas of the mandala. And each group was responsible for creating a shrine to that Buddha, and a ritual, and a puja. And then we set about performing those pujas at the appropriate time of day allocated for that Buddha. Did you know that the Buddhas have a time of day? Yeah. So you've got Amitabha at sunset. Yeah. You've got Ratnasambhava at noon. You've got Omoga Siddhi at midnight, and you have Akshobhya at dawn. So we'd had probably a fairly late puja for Omoga Siddhi, with the Shang Shang birds and everything going on. And the symbols, you know, quite late of the evening. And then I rang a rising bell at, I think, 4 o'clock in the morning, and the whole retreat got up It was raining, a little. The Hawke retreat got up and processed down from the dormitories, down to the field, to the marquee, where we rolled up the sides and sat and waited for Akshobhya to appear at dawn. Yeah, it was really nice, really, really nice. Good retreats, good memories of those retreats. But it was coming on to 1994, and the summer of 1994 was extremely hot. Yeah, I've got photographs to prove it. It was very hot. And I heard tell of a retreat going on in Somerset, which was being put on by a team who'd been leading meditation at Glastonbury Rock Festival. And it sounded very, very good idea, very attractive to go out and have a retreat in the countryside, under the trees, under canvas. So I went. And at that time, there was a slogan going round on the advertising boards. It was for beer, unfortunately. It was for Heineken. And it said that Heineken beer was the beer that refreshed the parts that other beers couldn't get to. Yeah? Anybody remember that one? I wouldn't know. Or I might have drunk Heineken once. It was horrible. Anyway, my summing up of that retreat, well, it was the retreat that refreshed the parts that other retreats couldn't get to. Yeah? Even pujas at dawn, or earthquakes, or stupas, or council meetings, or anything like that. Because there we were, sitting under a beautiful tree. There's a picture of it in one of my albums. A really gorgeous tree. I think it's a something sycamore, a Canadian sycamore tree. It became our holy tree. It became our sacred tree. And there we were, sitting out at dawn with the mists coming up over the levels, meditating. And I thought, this is how it was. This was how it was for the Buddha and his disciples. This incredible simplicity, this silence that is full, this silence that is full of the sounds of nature being alive, a very living silence. Silence is never meant to be dead. Silence is not absence of sound. Silence is something very subtle, very beautiful, that has to be really listened to. And I listened to that silence that morning and felt myself relax so deeply that I knew that my future path somehow had to be out in the fields, somehow had to be retreating in that way to nature. The theme on that retreat was just simply the elements. So we had a day for fire, a day for water, a day for air, a day for consciousness, a day for earth. And it was so enjoyable that we thought we'd carry on. So I began to make connections with these people, and it wasn't called Buddhafield at the beginning, it was called Upaya. And Upaya means skillful means. But one day, perhaps after a specially good puja or something, somebody said, Buddhafield, we're in a field, here's a Buddha field. Oh, Buddhafield, right. So Buddhafield started really in 1994. So I began to support the retreats there, and just loved it. It was incredibly chaotic. In some sort of fairy tale state that I was in, when I would come out of my tent in the morning and see the refreshment table with, you know, all the lids off the jars, the coffee pot sort of full with rainwater, the cake and the bread gone all soggy, I somehow thought this was all, you know, it was part of spiritual life or something strange. It didn't occur to me that people just were too sort of messy. I thought it was wonderful. And of course, you can guess, you know, in future years after that, I was the one who was always tidying up and trying to create some kind of order out of this chaos. But it had a lot of spontaneity, a lot of spontaneity. Even when we started the Butterfield Festivals, which I think are now, Butterfield Festivals now in its 17th year or something, even when we started them in the same field, we'd sit there and we'd think up the rituals that afternoon. Me and Dharma Bandhu, Alia Vajra, and a few others, and we'd just sit down and think, well, what do you think's happening? What do you think's needed for the ritual this evening? And we'd just come up with it and just do it. You know, we didn't plan an awful lot. And the festivals were just for a few hundred people in the beginning. And now, of course, it's grown hugely, if any of you've been along. Well, in the course of time, I felt that the pull for Butterfield was stronger than the pull to stay around here. So I eventually resigned as Mitra convener. I think it was 97, I can't be sure, somewhere around then, and went off on the road to Butterfield. I didn't want to wait till I was burnt out or anything like that. But so it's harder to leave something when the going's good, if you see what I mean, you know. I'd built up so much here, I'd done so much with, you know, the things I've mentioned, all these retreats and retreats at Waterhall, events here, the festival days, leading all the studies, seeing people through studies, seeing people become literate, seeing women become ordained, you know, it was my life, so much of my life. But this other life was calling, so then I went forth from here. And after two or three years, I'm not sure what, it came to me that what we needed in Butterfield was women's retreats. Up till then, everything had been mixed, men and women. And in the very early days, we tried to be really conventional. So we looked at the field and we said, right, men camp over there and women camp over there. we thought that should be the way to do things, but no, didn't really work. Happened, and nothing else happened either. Well, it might, I don't know. But there were some people, unfortunately, I don't remember who they were anyway, thought that Butterfield was up to no good. We were having hot tubs, and men and women were getting in hot tubs together. Hot tubs are full of hot water, and you stand in them and look at the stars, and the rain falls on you, and it's fantastic. And we were being men and women in the field in tents. And I don't know what they thought was going on. Now Butterfield's a household word, isn't it? Mm. But yeah, we had the courage, we had the strength of our convictions that there was something in this. We were reaching people who might very certainly would not have come to a city centre and walked in through a city centre door because of lifestyle, yeah? Because of money. So we were in a position around Shepton Mallet, which is near Glastonbury, to offer Dharma, to offer the Three Jewels to anyone who came along. And people came along who were homeless, people came along who were drugged out of their minds, people all kinds of people came. And welcome, this is something, maybe we can show you something that you can take with you on your pathway. I wanted there to be women's retreats, so I started doing them. And for some years, I ran two women's retreats a year. And there were upwards of 40 women coming on those retreats. And we had subjects such as Buddhist heroines, both human and spiritual, archetypal. And we were the first to explore the five female Buddhas. You know the mandala, you understand, it's actually 10 Buddhas, arbitrarily called male and female, but no one had really looked into the qualities of the female Buddhas, so we were one of the ones who did that. And later on we moved up to the Wye Valley, which is an extraordinarily beautiful place. We've seen some of the photos, and those were some of the most wonderful retreats as well. Seeing through the eyes of wisdom was one. And we danced and we sang and we played music and sat in the hot tubs. And yeah, generally had a really good time. Well, then, of course, not of course, but it so happened that women asked to become mitras. How could they do that? No Mitra convener. You had to have a Mitra convener. And they weren't going to city centres. So you can guess what happened. I'll be Mitra convener then. And so I did. And that was lovely. So then we could have Mitra, women Mitras in Butterfield. And when Butterfield eventually bought some land at Broad Hembury, yeah, I remember having some Mitra ceremonies up there. And Desiree is one, and she's going to be ordained this year. Susie Cohen, who's Dharma Jyoti. Anyway, she's ordained, yeah. And Mamukshu's ordained. Yeah, so gradually, you know, things evolved in that manner. It's talked about homelessness. Some of the people who came to us weren't the only homeless ones. Most of the team was by then. We kept all our stuff, all the equipment, in a house in Streatham, which at one time had been a women's community, Kadiravani. But either, you know, some people drifted off to Brighton, London. We didn't necessarily have permanent homes. So in the year 2000, we thought maybe we should get one. And we rented a house in Devon for 6 months. We thought that would do it. We can spend the winter together, talk about the next season, and then get back on the road. They're still there, 12 years on. And the good news is the rent's the same. Yeah, the rent hasn't gone up. Marvellous landlord. So I was there for a while. I found myself in a mixed community. It was the first time I'd been in a community. I'd lived pretty much on my own over here, apart from my daughter, whom I haven't probably time to say much about, but here she is on this photo, aged 14, at my ordination. She came to my ordination. Time went on. I began to feel I wasn't putting in as much as I had done. And I began to get a bit unwell. And the long and short of it was that I got too ill to work, really. I had a rapid growth of fibroids and I had too much pain. So I decided I should leave. I didn't want to go and be operated on. I thought I should probably look for some other way to live. And so I went to Wales. I knew two women there. But not long after I got there, they left. So I found myself near some women, on an open piece of land, commonly owned piece of land. And I didn't know anyone. This was the other going forth. I went forth from all the security I'd known, and for a while, from all the friendships I'd known, from all the safety, from all the affirmation, from all the support that I'd had here and in Butterfield. But something was pulling me on again. I'd been attracted to an archetypal figure called Magic Ladron. She created a practice called the Chod, which in essence is to do with, well, total sacrifice of oneself. It's a graphic practice. I didn't take it up in that form, but I was very attracted to her after I found her in the cupboard at Cahuda. What? Yes. Well, I found her picture in a cupboard at Cahuda when I was looking for some shrine materials. The cupboard belonged to Gunavati then. And, you know, one of those instant things where you recognise as a heart just leaps out, even if it was a picture. So she was in my mind. But I think, in effect, that's what happened to me. I then sort of embarked on kind of chod practice because there was nothing to sustain me or to rely on. I didn't want to look for work. And when I got there, I didn't tell people my Buddhist name, because I felt there'd be expectations or preconceived ideas, and I just wanted to find out what I was doing there, what I'd left Butterfield for. So I went and lived in a little barn and put a tarpaulin over the rafters to make a little cave for myself, and then heard of a place I could go and rent, could go and live. So the day that I dismantled my cave, I'd forgotten the rocks that I'd placed to hold the tarpaulins down and sustained a rather unpleasant injury to my head. Oh dear, I think it affected me more than I knew. So I just set about the task of learning to look after myself, learning to rely on myself. And perhaps I hadn't done that, you know, since I was in my teens or my early 20s. I'd never been on my own. I'd not had to be totally self-reliant. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't even know what it was I liked to eat, particularly. If you've been in communal situations for a long time, you just all do the same sort of thing. It was even like going out and finding a cup or a mug that I took a fancy to and knew it would stay there, you know. So it was sort of, going back to some kind of basics. So in this time, I think it's been a bit of time of reclamation and a time of rediscovering. It's gone on for about 6 or 7 years of simply living quietly and finding out more about me, you know, separate from all the things that I'd been doing before. So in sort of swift order, I discovered dry stone walling. You know what a dry stone wall is? It's a wall without any mortar, it's natural stones, and I have a passion for the stones. And I just get a huge amount of satisfaction from creating little stone walls and creating little landscapes when the weather's nice. Maybe that was why the stone fell on me, I don't know, it was trying to tell me something. What a way, I've still got a dent in my head. Anyway, I've been learning Welsh now for 2 years. I'm very, very much drawn to the Welsh culture and traditions, which are very much still alive and accessible. I go to Welsh singing group, taking up the fiddle again, Welsh fiddle tunes. So I'm having a great time, really. But last year I began to feel that I wanted to sort of step out into the world a bit more again. And I thought that, you know, maybe it would be nice to have a women's retreat sort of nearby. So I went to see someone I know who happens to have land, who happens to have tents, who happens to have marquees, and all the things that go with it. And her name is Helen the Hat. And if you've been to Butterfield, if you go to the children's area, there's Helen the Hat. You'll never forget her. She has blonde dreads sort of down to about here now. And she lives about 20 miles away from me. And I said, Helen, what about a women's retreat? And she said, yes, I've been praying to have retreats here, because she is now a mitra. She's now a mitra. So we got one together. And, you know, during this time, my interest, or I had the opportunity to look more into the Celtic background, the Celtic heritage of the British Isles, and in particular Wales, I suppose. And my feeling is that there's something there which, you know, can help us to be really, literally quite grounded in our own past. And I think that's, you know, as individuals and as a sort of race, to be grounded in where we are is absolutely vital to progress. And so much has been forgotten in our land of where we've come from. So I describe my style of retreat, if you like, as a sort of Celtic Buddhist fusion. Yeah. It's an exploration. Yeah, an exploration of how we can, rejoice in the richness of where we've come from, and also look up to where we might be going. So I've got another one. We're doing another one. I've put some flyers out, take the opportunity to advertise this. And it's touching the earth with the Buddha at Beltane. Beltane is one of the major fire festivals in the Celtic tradition. It marks the real beginning of spring. In the old days, of course, it was a time of rushing off into the woods and getting up to mischief, bringing home the maypole, bringing home Jack in the Green, dancing and singing and just rejoicing, celebrating in the renewal, in the fertility of earth, in all the richness that was coming forth at that time. So it's a celebration of the Buddha's enlightenment, Buddha reaching the peak of his attainments. So my plan is to put the two together this time, and if anybody here feels like an adventure, you can see where to come on the flyer. You'd be most welcome. I suspect I should be completed.
Nearly, yes.
All right. Well, I think I have. taken you on a bit of a ramble. No. We haven't been to Tuscany. And I haven't told you about Maureen. I've not been to Akashavana. I might go at some time. But when we began, when it was possible for women to ordain women, there was a time when we went to this place in Tuscany called Il Convento. And I went on the first one of those, and I was the one who made all the shrines in the cloisters. And there were tortoises walking about, and wild boars in the forest, and Shubha was ordained there. It was lovely. And the Mogasiddhi shrine caught fire. There wasn't any earthquakes, but a Mogasiddhi shrine caught fire in the middle of a thunderstorm. I rushed into the cloister to get out of the rain, and this bolt of lightning came down and struck a Mogasiddhi shrine, and it was up just like that. Oh, it was very good. So that was a lovely another piece of travelling. Il Convento had been used by the men before they got Guhyaloka, and then I don't know how many Tuscanies there were for women. It meant that there could be longer ordination retreats, basically. Certainly a lot longer than the week I got, not knowing what was in store. Yes, and my story tonight, my tale, would not be complete without telling you a bit about Maureen. Because Maureen was my companion for nigh on 21 years. I was there just after her birth when she came home to live with me in Albion Drive, or Lansdowne Drive, I think it was, along with her four brothers and sisters. And we all lived in this little flat. And Maureen was by far the most gregarious of that family. When the doorbell went, when there was a knock at the door, Maureen would be the first to get to the door to greet the visitor and embrace them and give them a big kiss and cling on to them, and then come in and say, okay, thank you, Maureen, it's lovely. Now, go and have some milk. You may be wondering a little, if you haven't guessed, that Maureen had 4 feet and a lot of fur. Maureen was a cat. Maureen was quite an exceptional cat. And she eventually started coming on retreats. She came to Butterfield, and in her own way, she was a bit of a teacher. Now, I know you might think, somebody might think, oh, she's getting really sentimental here and so forth. But if you live closely with animals and observe, what's going on. I mean, I live very near to sheep. And they're not all just sheep, they have distinct characters and ways of being. All animals have got incredible intelligence. I love having animals around. On my retreats, on our retreats, last one we had dogs and cats, and they were some of the best attendees in the shrine. they would stay the whole time. Grapus would go round and just see everyone's posture was okay. There's a little grey cat, he'd give you a little pat on the knee if your knee wasn't quite down. Help in that way. And they're very calming presence. Yeah, animals can be in the shrine room. Well, Maureen liked light coming on retreats, and so she just loved people. She just really loved people. She was unfailingly, you know, expressing metta, friendliness. I mean, can any of us honestly say that whoever we meet in a day, we're absolutely rapturous to meet them? We're just bowled over with delight. You know, how are you? And we may not got to give them a big kiss, but, you know, so I'm really pleased to see you. Maureen always was. And besides this incredible metta that she showed, she was very mindful. She was a mindfulness teacher. How did she do that? By laying across the threshold of the tea tent. You can think about it, you know, think about it. Well, the tents are only lit by little candle lanterns. It's quite dark at night. I don't think we'd even had solar by then. You know, solar hadn't come along. So Maureen would lie across the threshold, and inevitably somebody would... And there'd be a wail, a screech. Oh, Maureen, I didn't see you there. And, you know, there would be people who avowedly just didn't like cats at all, didn't see cats, didn't hear cats, didn't want to know about cats. I saw so many people develop a relationship to this cat. It really, you know, quite independently. Didn't know I was observing. So she kept you mindful like that, you know, where you're treading. And she obviously must have known that somebody was going to tread on her, but she still laid across the threshold. She came to WIT, Women in Tune. That was another event that Butterfield put a cafe on. Women in Tune, a big women's music festival in Wales in August. I was in a cafe there. She came there, but sadly she passed away. But she was about 21. So, yeah, lovely Maureen. Yes. I think that will do for the moment.